talk about today was walking meditation. And what I had in mind was to expand or give you the instructions on walking meditation as an expansion of the instructions that I gave during the 5-week introductory course that just ended a few weeks ago. And usually during the introductory courses, I will give walking instructions, but I didn't this last time. And so I thought this would be a good time to make up for that. And also by having this usually I only take about 10 or 15 minutes to talk about walking meditation. And now I have more time to devote to it. And I could talk, walking is really a wonderful practice, really a wonderful activity. And so I thought that I could use more time. It'd be nice, rich to spend more time talking about it. So, in the Buddhist tradition, the ordinary activities that we engage ourselves in are very highly respected. The spiritual or the sublime or the ultimate or whatever is often found through the ordinary activities of daily life. And so the ordinary activities of life are not considered to be separate from spiritual practice, but are really I don't want to say necessarily the heart either, but they are the spiritual practice, and they're not separate from the spiritual practice. And if your spiritual practice is only what you do in your meditation time, sitting on a cushion, then it's a very limited spiritual life. And I like the expression spiritual life because I think Thomas Merton said a spiritual life is first of all a life. It's a way of living. And it needs to inform the rest of your life. And the beauty of mindfulness practice is it's a practice that you can do in any activity that you find yourself doing. So in the Buddhist tradition, something called the four dignities of human beings, the four dignities. And the four dignities are the four major ways in which you can be in the world. You can either be standing, you can be sitting, you can be walking or lying down, or some kind of combination or in between those four. And those are considered to be the four basic ways in which you can kind of conduct our life. And those are called the four dignities. I think it's really beautiful. They call them dignities. And, there's some dignity in them. There's some worth in them. There's some value in these four activities. And we talked a lot about sitting practice. And occasionally, I've done this kind of for the more senior students that I've had do sometimes an exercise where I ask them to just be sitting there in meditation and then feel how they're sitting. And then to shift their inner sense or maybe even their posture to so they can sit with dignity when they're sitting there. And usually we see people shift a little bit and they'll straighten up a little bit. And then I'll say, after they've kind of done that, then I say, now around that feeling of dignity, relax and soften. Because what happens is dignity is a little bit kind of a funny word for us in the West. And it can have kind of a stiff quality, kind of stiff upper lip, or, you know, people get kind of like military-like. But I think dignity is a beautiful word. And I think we're discovering our dignity. I think a Buddha is someone who has a lot of dignity. But it's very soft and very open. And so we've talked a lot in presence. When we... it's taught as a meditation practice in its own right. And a lot of people associate meditation with sitting cross-legged, sitting, you know, on a cushion or sitting in a chair, sitting. And so because of that, they think, well, sitting is where it's really at. And if I'm going to, whatever, get enlightened or get whatever, I have to do it sitting. And or walking, well, that seems kind of silly or that's not really the real thing. And so they don't pay any attention to it and they don't do it. Walking meditation is as powerful a form of meditation as sitting meditation. And for some people, it even works better to do walking meditation than it is to do sitting meditation. And I've known people whose primary meditation practice is to walking. Instead of sitting half an hour when they get up in the morning, they walk for half an hour, do half an hour walking meditation. Where walking meditation becomes very important, though, for the formal practice is when you go on retreat. If you go on a one day, if you sit for any period longer than your normal kind of sitting period, and that's what we do in retreats. We sit maybe for half a day or a full day or for 10 days or whatever. We'll sit for a certain length of time, usually 45 minutes, and then we'll alternate that with 45 minutes, equal length of time of walking meditation. And there's a wonderful rhythm through the day of a period of sitting and a period of walking, a period of sitting, a period of walking. Some beginners will think that the walking meditation and retreat is designed to just give relief to the knees. And so that's the, you know, they think, well, that's, you know, it's a kind of vacation time. But it is the way these retreats are designed is in such a way to balance the various factors of mind that come into play when you do meditation practice. And there are many factors that come into play and come into balance as you practice. But the most common one, the most obvious one to talk about in this relationship is the balance between energy and concentration. And concentration in Buddhist psychology is considered to be almost synonymous with calm. The tendency when people get concentrated or calm, or if they just simply sit on their tushes for a long time, don't do anything, is the energy level drops. And if you sit all the time, you start falling asleep or get very dull or clouded in your mind. So we have this walking meditation that brings in the balance of energy. If you walked all the time, walking would tend to be agitating. It's too much energy, and you start thinking too much. So we have then the sitting to kind of bring some calm. And if you go through a day of alternating between the two, there's a wonderful, not only a balance between them, but a building of them. They both can build in greater intensity, but they can build in greater intensity because they have their balanced against each other. So you can have more and more energy in a kind of way, and then parallel to that, more and more concentration. But if you have any one of them out of balance, it's too much, you end up with some kind of problems. So walking is very important like that. One of the things one of the reasons I like walking meditation a lot is that it's sitting meditation doesn't look, a lot of us sit during the day, but sitting meditation doesn't look very much like our ordinary life. But walking meditation looks much more like our ordinary life because it's activity, it's meditation and movement, and we're often walking a lot anyway. And so in terms of bridging the mindfulness practice between sitting, formally sitting, and daily life, the walking practice works very well. It's a very nice bridge. So if you can learn to not only to do it, but to appreciate it. The way that the walking meditation is done formally, it can be done informally anytime you're walking anywhere. And some of the most delightful times of practicing just in daily life has been starting to be mindful as I walk, just walking wherever I walk. And it's been more satisfying me to kind of be present for the walking than it has been just let my mind kind of wander wherever it tends to wander. Kind of exude mental diarrhea, which is often where, you know, the mind is kind of scattered and kind of lost. And it's very, very settling, very, has a lot of integrity just to walk and be mindful and be present, be open. So the way the formal walking practice is done is by choosing a walkway, a pathway for yourself that's somewhere between 20 and 30 paces long, 20 and 40 feet long. It can be shorter if you're indoors and you don't have any more room. But choosing some path and then simply walking back and forth. And the reason to walk back and forth in the same place is if you wandered around doing walking meditation anywhere you wanted, just kind of, some people want to just kind of wander around the block or the woods or just whatever, is then you're constantly having to negotiate where to turn right and where to turn left and what rock to step over and what gutter to avoid and what puddle to avoid or whatever. And there's all these very subtle decisions that have to be made. And you have to be kind of alert to a certain kind of, different kind of way to kind of figure out where you're coming to. If you're walking back and forth the same 20 paces over and over again, pretty soon you know the route. And that level of kind of conceptual thinking is put to rest and you don't have to be engaged in it. And you can really kind of settle into the actual process of walking much more rather than negotiating where you're walking. And also some people ask, why not just walk in a circle? It seems like walking in a circle is nice. And part of the reason we're not walking in a circle is walking in a circle, it becomes a continuous action. And the mind has a way of continuously thinking. And if you have continuous action, the continuous action can somehow hide continuous thinking. And you end up thinking much more than you're actually present for your walking. If you walk back and forth, you have to actually kind of stop what you're doing, turn around, and start again. And so your action is being interrupted, and you're more likely, because the action is interrupted, to notice if your mind is really scattered a lot, not really present. It's a way of kind of checking in and coming into the present. So we walk back and forth. And if we're walking somewhat slow, I actually will, which is anything slower than a normal maybe city pace, I think coming to a full stop at the end of the walk, turning around, stopping, and then starting again is really the best way. So you have that's really an interruption of your potential thinking mind and really can be grounded in the present again, and then you start again. What we pay attention to when we do walking meditation is either the soles of the feet as the sensations change as you walk, or the calves, the lower legs below the knees, the sensations in the muscles as they go through the various phases of walking. Or sometimes sometimes you can be aware of the whole leg. And sometimes if you're walking particularly fast, sometimes it's nice just to feel the whole body moving. But it's usually best to have some more focused anchor for the awareness. And it's usually the feet or the lower legs. And whereas in sitting practice, the anchor or the center of the meditation practice is the breath, in walking meditation, the center, the anchor of the practice is the feet and returning to the feet. And some people will think, well, the breath seems like a wonderful spiritual subject. The word spiritual contains the word breath in the very name of it. Spiritus means breath in Latin. But feet, you know, that's kind of like plebeian, right? And that doesn't seem to, you know, what's so spiritual about that? But in mindfulness practice, everything has equal value. And you can develop a very deep understanding and states of meditation by bringing your awareness to your feet as you walk. However, one of the most important things you should do when you do walking meditation is establish a pace that you can walk in. And the pace that you should walk in is a pace that brings you ease. And almost anyone can go for a walk and find a pace that brings ease. People, when they're upset or angry or whatever, will go for a walk around the block and it brings some calm. It's a wonderful way to walk. If you're really angry, go for a walk and allow yourself to be angry, but just walk. And you know, walk fast, you know. Walking is really great. And after you've walked for a while, you'll find yourself that the energy of the anger has not only dissipated, but there's a way in which, for me at least, that I can really be present for the anger. I'm not going to deny it or push it away. Really allow it to be there. Give it space. And walk and walk, and then it dissipates and takes care of itself. And we walk often just to find some ease. So to find some ease. And this is a very important point that I like to stress. It isn't because this is not often taught by the Vipassana teachers, that you're supposed to have a pace of ease when you do your walking meditation. So you see all these people walking in kind of artificial ways. And especially sometimes very, very slowly before that it's appropriate to walk slow. And it becomes kind of a strain to walk slow. And when I first started doing walking meditation, I was just told to go out and walk, and everybody else was walking really slow, so I walked really slow. And by the end of the walking period, I was more agitated than I was at the end of at the beginning. After a while of this, I thought that something's not right here. So I just gave up, kind of, and went for a walk in the woods. And it was a casual walk, just kind of walking around. But I was mindful. I stayed somewhat mindful and aware of what was going on. And I came back from that walk in the woods much more mindful and present with myself than I was doing the formal walking meditation. So rather than, you know, chucking the formal walking meditation completely, what I did was try to bring that attitude or spirit of walking at ease in the woods to the formal walking back and forth. And if you go in retreat, I'll warn you that there's a lot of people who walk very, very slow in retreat. And sometimes they walk so slow, like in a longer retreat, like real long retreat, they really get into walking slow, or maybe competitively slow, Who can give a And sometimes you look at them, you even wonder, are they really walking at all? Are they standing still or are they walking? But you come back 10 minutes later and, you know, they've gone a little bit further. And anyways, people walk really slow. And because there's a number of people, a lot of people walking slow, there's a certain kind of peer pressure to walk slow. So I implore you, don't succumb to peer pressure. Find a pace that brings you ease. And that pace can be anything between walking like a snail and power walking. My teacher in Burma, he power walked when he walked. And it would be hard for me to run as fast as he walked. And there was actually a hallway that was built only for walking meditation. It looked kind of like a bowling alley. It was about this wide, and solid wood floor, and really long, and had a door in the middle, and you go in, and just you'd walk, and or you just shoo, shoo, shoo. And so you don't have to power walk, but the point is to find some pace that brings you ease. And sometimes ease will be faster than other times, and sometimes it'll be slower. And so bring you to find some ease in your walking back and forth. Once you've found your ease, then allow yourself to let your awareness sink or settle into your feet and your lower legs. And become aware. Center yourself, center your awareness on those places. Rest your awareness on your feet and your legs. And if the mind wanders away, just come back to your feet and let your awareness rest there. And if the mind wanders away, come back. And it might seem like it's an uninteresting subject, the feet. But it can bring a lot of subtleness, a lot of presence, and help you stay more grounded in the present moment in a very useful way. And if you really get into it, it can open up to deeper insights into your life, into reality, just as the breath can do. So we choose this walkway, which is about 20 to 40 feet long. We walk back and forth, and finding your pace of ease. And usually, if you're walking at somewhat slow pace, or regular pace, we pay attention to the foot that is doing the stepping. And then when you finish stepping, you bring your attention to the back foot and be aware of it stepping forward. If you're walking really fast, like if you're walking around, sometimes even at normal pace, especially like if you want to do this kind of walking around Palo Alto or your home or something, sometimes just be aware of the contact of the feet against the ground. It's very grounding to feel the ground, feel the earth. It's remarkable how many of us will spend a whole day like walking all over the place and never touch the earth. We're always touching something which is, human-made, cement and linoleum and whatever. And it's great just to go out and walk on the earth and do that occasionally, each day. But anyway, just feel the contact. But if you're walking kind of slower, it's the step that the leg is doing the stepping. And then there's an aid to help us be more mindful while we're walking. You can label the steps, like you can label the breath rising, falling, or in and out. And we label our experience in Vipassana. So you can label your walking. And this, you can choose, what you want to label it as. You can say, just walking for each step, or stepping. But I think it's a little bit better to say, left, right, left, because it kind of, to help you nudge or encourage the mind to go to the foot that's actually doing the stepping, you can say, label that foot, left, then right. But also it's very cute, because what you'll find at some point is you're walking along and you'll go right, left, right, left. And that's a kind of small, if you notice that, it's a suggestion that your mindfulness has slipped a little bit. You're not very present. It's become mechanical. And just do that. And be sensitive as you walk that the pace that you walk will vary. And so sometimes you'll start at a certain pace, and the second half of your walking period, you'll naturally want to go slower. And so sometimes you need to slow down. And sometimes it's really appropriate to walk really slow. When people walk really slow when they do walking meditation, then they sometimes break up the labeling of the experience into three stages of the walking. And that is lifting, they label lifting of the foot, then they label moving or moving the foot through the air, and then they label placing, or placing the foot on the ground. So lifting, moving, placing. But sometimes people do that, it also starts becoming kind of artificial, the walking. It's kind of like, they start going, you see sometimes people going like this, kind of lifting their foot really high, holding it for a second, and then kind of moving it forward, and then holding it for a second, and then stepping it down. They look like kind of like these crumb cartoons, you know, trucking. you know, you just walk natural. The only way you can be at ease is if you walk somewhat natural. And even if you walk really slow, you know, just be natural about it. Just walk kind of. Depends. It's no rule. Just whatever seems to suit you. If the ground is dirty, you might want, you know. And it's nice to walk barefoot because there's often more sensations then. But if the ground is cold or dirty or something. Walking is a wonderful activity outside of meditation. It's a wonderful way to spend time just walking around, walking. But one of the things about walking is, like meditation is kind of like a metaphor for life, I guess, and a microcosm of your life. So walking also can be a microcosm of your life, the attitude in which you walk, the way you walk. And often people, most people when they walk to get somewhere, which may be appropriate enough. But any experience, anything that we do, can perhaps be divided into two aspects. There is the goal of the activity, the purpose of the activity, where you're going, what you're doing, and there's the process of the activity. And a lot of people and a lot of focus mostly on the goal, or that's the primary kind of the weight of the attention, or the attention, the intention, the is in the realm of the goal. And that's, I think because of that's where a lot of people get caught and attached and confused and upset, and because of a kind of exclusive focus on the goal, or getting it or not getting it, or being disappointed. A whole other important area is the process of our life, the process of our activity. And it's the process area which has much more to do with spiritual life. Spiritual life, I would argue, has very little to do with the particular goals of our life, but has a lot to do with the process by which we do, the how of how we do things. How we cook our food, how we wash the dishes, how we talk to our friends, how we drive our car to work. We have to get to work, that's the goal, is to get to work. But how you get to work, how you drive, that has to do with spiritual life. You know, getting to work as quickly as you can is not particularly spiritual. But how you get there. And we were talking earlier today with some people about how some parents begin driving differently once they have kids. And I know some that start driving differently because when they're driving alone, it doesn't matter if they kind of go 100 miles an hour and drive off the cliff. It seems like the way they drive doesn't seem to matter one bit. But as soon as they have kids, they don't want to drive that way anymore. It becomes, you know, they want to drive really carefully because of this precious load they have. Or someone else who said this afternoon that when she had kids, or her kids started driving, I think it was, when her kids started driving, she said that she didn't want, she wanted to drive much more carefully and respectfully to influence the general kind of in traffic so that kind of the perfume, the perfume, so that everybody hopefully will drive carefully because her kids were on the road now. the process, the how of what we do, and you can look at this with walking also, and it's really walking meditation is really wonderful because you're not getting anywhere. You know, you might think you're supposed to get to, you know, you're going back and forth. You're not trying to get anywhere, and so it can be very, for some people, very profound because they can suddenly drop into the body instead of projecting themselves in front of the body, kind of reaching forward to get somewhere. Nothing's happening. You're just going back and forth. But you can experiment with the how of walking in the rest of your life also. And focus more on how do you walk, because you're walking all the time. How are you walking in this moment? Not necessarily where you're trying to get to. And there are people who practice this particular points of the day. They'll practice it from their leaving their house until getting to the car in the morning, or leaving the car to walk to the workplace every day. These are particular times of walking that have significance, or they've selected to be significant, and they'll pay attention to the how they walk at that time. And walk in such a way that maybe the goal is not so important. Or one exercise that sometimes is given is maybe for a week, or maybe just once, for an hour, go for a walk without any direction, directionless walk, and just kind of wander around for a whole hour without any, trying going anywhere in particular. And for some people, this is the first time they've done it in years and years. And it can be a radical thing just to walk for a whole hour without any purpose or any place you're supposed to go. If you go walking up on Skyline, you know, you have to, you're trying to get to the other, you know, one trailhead to the other, or get to the, you know, you're trying to get something. But just to walk around wherever, from your home in an hour, in any direction, directionless, to wander around. But the how, and image that I find it's been very useful for walking meditation, for walking in general, is the idea, maybe it's not an image, but the idea that, and normally we don't think this way, that, but rather than we taking our body for a walk, when you go walking, let your body take you for a walk. Try that. And you'll find if you do that, you're probably more relaxed, you're more settled on yourself, you're not ahead of yourself trying to get somewhere. You're kind of going along for the ride. You can relax and settle back in the seat. And just allow your body to kind of carry you. And it's wonderful to do that. And sometimes you can get a sense that the body's carrying you and the environment just is also coming towards you. And just kind of just want, everything's coming towards you. Just, and you can just relax and kind of feel the magic of just being aware. Being at the center of your universe. So you can try that even either during formal walking or just any time, letting your body carry you. How? Paying attention to the how. And then I'll tell, to end, I'll tell a story. A story from this Buddhist sutras. There was a mass murderer in the time of the Buddha. And the story goes that his name was Angulimala. And Angula means a finger. And Mala means like a necklace. And he had a necklace made of all the fingers of all his victims. One finger for each of them. And the story is he had killed 999 people. And he needed he wanted 1,000 for his necklace. And he was out in the woods. And everybody was afraid of him. All the villagers were afraid and stayed away from him. And he lived in this forest. And he was about to kill his 1,000th victim. And the Buddha got wind of it. And so the Buddha said, I'm going to go and see this guy. And people said, no, don't go. Don't go. This guy's dangerous. So he went, and he went walking through the forest very calmly. Kind of probably was doing walking meditation. And Angulimala saw this Buddhist monk and said, oh boy, this is great. A Buddhist monk, you know, he'd be easy, pray. And so he started walking after the Buddha. And the Buddha just walked calmly. And Angulimala started walking faster to catch up to him. And the faster he walked, the greater the distance. And he started running after the Buddha. And the Buddha just kept walking very calmly and serenely. And the faster the guy ran to the Buddha, the greater the distance. So finally he yelled out to the Buddha and said, stop, stop. And the Buddha kept walking and just said, I stopped long ago. You're still running. It wasn't just being literal. He was being as a metaphor for the guy for their respective lives. And this caught this murderer's attention enough that he became the Buddha's disciple. And he understood that the Buddha had stopped all the frantic running around, all the kind of behavior that's based on kind of... Maybe it's a sweet old grandmotherly woman who happens to be built kind of huskily, who's going to her teach violin to some, you know, to her violin class. And you realize, boy, there's a big difference between what I thought and what's actually happening. And that's kind of dramatic. But as your mindfulness gets stronger, you see in more and more subtler ways the difference between how we think about something and what's actually happening. And we know what's actually happening because we are aware of it. We sense it, we perceive it. We can experience it without a lot of overlay of stories and ideas. So one example, maybe more in meditation practice, is you can have a pain in your knee. And or say that's maybe that's not a good example. Say you have a pain in your lower back inside, and you might start thinking about, oh, I have a pain, and what is it? And you know, it's maybe it's a tumor, and you know, I'm sure it's a tumor. Matter of fact, you know, it feels like there's pressure and it's bulging and bursting, and it's about to burst and you know, ooze all the stuff all over my insides, and you know, and it's this whole story. You're thinking about it. As opposed to what is the actual experience? The actual experience is pressure and hardness and tightness, and you know, and there's a big difference between pressure and tightness, feeling that, and interpreting it as this big story about a tumor and cancer and you're dying tomorrow and whatever. So distinguishing a little bit between that, there's a difference between what we think and what we're experiencing. If we can see that, then we can take more responsibility for what we're thinking. And we can choose our stories. And we say, oh, that's not necessarily a useful story to have, or maybe that's not even true, maybe that's an interpretation. There's this wonderful little exchange that I read between a therapist, psychotherapist, and his client. And the client says, it's something like you know, something grandiose, like I can't find the meaning of life, and I feel completely lost in life, and I'm wondering what's going to happen when I die, and all kinds of things. And the therapist says, "Did you notice that you left your lights on in your car?" Or someone, in another exchange, someone says, so that the client says, I'm always the last person ever noticed, and my life never goes the way it should be going, and seems so hopeless, my life. And the therapist says, do you notice you use the word never and always a lot? So because the person is lost in their story and their ideas, and if you're lost too much in your ideas, or someone says, the other story was, someone says, I have no pleasure in my life. And the therapist says, how is it to drink that Pepsi you're drinking? You know, Pepsi may be sweet and pleasant. And people tend to be lost in their stories so much, in their ideas, they don't notice the immediate pleasure that's happening right now if they just relax. And then your question is, what's the difference between the self and thinking? Well, self and awareness. Some people, some religions equate awareness and self. The true self is the same as awareness. But Buddhists don't do that. What the Buddhists and what maybe some psychotherapists nowadays would say is what we experience and we think of as a self is made up of many different aspects, many different kinds of thoughts and perceptions and mental functions and emotions. It's a combination of many different things. And one of those things is thinking. But it's also made up of our body, it's made up of our emotions, it's made up of our perceptions. All those things come together. It is not just this one thing called thinking. But the world of thinking is where we tend to identify. Because it's in the world of thought that we become a rich person, or a smart person, or a beautiful person, or an inadequate person, or an unworthy person, or whatever. It has a lot to do with the world of thoughts and what we're thinking. So if people tend to identify with their thinking, and then they get into trouble. But what the self is much more than just thoughts. It's made up of many different things. And in the final analysis, from a Buddhist point of view, the whole combination of stuff is, in a sense, the self. But it's like saying, if you go to Stanford University and you're going to give someone a tour and you've shown them where the library is and the student union is and the different buildings are, and you show them all these different places, and then the person says, well, that's all fine, but where's Stanford University? Well, you know, I showed you, there's a library, and yeah, you showed me, that's the library, and that's, but where's Stanford University? The self is like that in Buddhism. We're made up of all these different parts, but if you try to look in those parts for something which is a self, it's as trying to look for something which is Stanford University that you can point to as a, you know. And so we're just, what we tend to do, and this is what we tend to get in trouble, is we think that the library is Stanford. Or we think the bookstore is Stanford. And so we put all our money into the library and we forget the engineering department. It's actually the opposite. or we think that our bank account is ourself, and so we kind of constantly thinking about how much money we have in the bank account or what kind of car we drive, because that's really where the self is. Or we think that our body is ourselves, so people do all the stuff to their body. Or people think that their emotions are themselves, and so they really identify with their emotions. Or there's all these things that we hook onto, and it's that hooking onto one thing as the self that then we become inflexible. And reality is something which is inherently flexible. So if an inflexible thing meets something which is flexible, you're asking for trouble. And that contact between inflexible ideas and attachments and the inherent flexibility of reality is what's called in Buddhism dukkha, or suffering. And we're trying to find some way to live in the flexibility of reality with a flexible heart and a flexible mind. So the two are compatible, they get along. Yes?
I have a fairly related question. I just found that I don't feel any separation between my thoughts and my awareness. So I try to become aware of my thoughts, and as soon as I became aware that I was thinking, I would stop that thought. I don't really feel any difference between myself and my thoughts, I guess. But I don't see how to make any space to observe
what's
happening.
I would say, don't worry about it. Just keep being aware and see what happens. But is it your thoughts the only part that's you, or is there other parts that are also you?
No, I feel like there's other parts that are me. But
so it's one aspect of you then.
But it seems like I can notice feeling or sensation much easier than I can notice thinking. It feels like thinking, I don't understand how to do that.
We'll just wait until you're preoccupied. When you have, so at some point you'll have some kind of compulsive thinking, and bringing awareness to it, it won't go away so easily.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
And if they're going away easily, then you're lucky. Then probably you don't have, you're kind of gifted and don't have a lot of strong attachments around thoughts. Which could be. Some people have much stronger attachments towards emotions. And so the world of thoughts and stories doesn't really grab them so much. And so you bring awareness to it, and you know, the identification vanishes and goes away. But your anger, I mean, that's, you know, you that's going to stay. You know, you're going to be aware of that really well, because and anger only continues through time because we are participating in it. If we didn't participate, anger would just dissipate. And so there's some identification there, some form or other. So maybe you're that kind of person. And some people are more thought people, and they're lost in stories a lot. Yeah?
I have a joke and a request for maybe a book to read. The joke is from Jack Kornfield, The Path of the Heart, where he's telling a story about Picasso and a collector. The collector saying, well, why are your paintings so unreal? And he said, why can't they be real like this picture of my wife? And Picasso looked at the picture and said, oh, she's so small and flat. But I really I really enjoyed that book and his book of stories. I wonder if you could recommend another book.
If you read that book, Path with Heart, you might try reading Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, mm-hmm. by Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, or you might read Joseph Goldstein has two books. Both of them, which are quite good. And Stephen Levine has a book called Gradual Awakening. Yes?
I came in late. Is this a time where we can just ask questions?
This is going to be the last one.
What you said about anger, if we don't participate in it, it can dissipate. Do you think that's true of all emotions?
No.
Like fear?
Yes. And I mean, sometimes fear is appropriate, and it's appropriate to participate in it and let it continue through time. And part of wisdom is knowing the difference between appropriate fear and inappropriate fear. If the truck is barreling down at 60 miles an hour and you're standing, and I think it's a wonderful idea of stopping what we're doing in order to pay attention, stopping what we're doing, a frantic running around. And it's interesting, in Chinese, when the Chinese translated Buddhist terms into their language, they translated the character for concentration, the word concentration, samadhi, they translated it into the name of the character for stopping. And the character for the word mindfulness was translated into the character for seeing. And the two understood to go together. You stop and look. So stop your life enough, slow down enough, in order to look at what's going on. Look at your life. And if your life is frantic and you're always in a rush and a hurry, you can't be happy. It's impossible. If you're rushing around, you can't be happy. You can do a lot of things. You can have speed and be happy, but rushing, you can't be happy. And if happiness is important for you, if the how of how you live your life is important, stop, or at least slow down. Stop, look, walk, sit, stand. Standing meditation also. And there's lying down meditation, which can be done. But that's dangerous. I hope that some of you try it, and there's various ways of doing walking, ways of incorporating this into your daily practice outside of retreat, which is a regular part of the schedule. Some of you might find that you prefer to walk rather than sit. You wake up early in the morning, you want to meditate, but you're really sleepy, and so maybe you want to do walking instead, walking meditation. Or what a lot of people do is they'll walk first and then they'll sit. So you walk for 15 minutes or 10 minutes, and you might walk kind of fast to get the energy and wake up, and then you sit down for another, whatever long you're sitting for. And my teacher in Burma, when I was on retreat with him, he said, Gil, I want you always to walk before you sit. Because I was one of those kind of people who didn't know any better. And so I wanted to sit a lot. And he said, no, you have to always walk before you sit. So whenever, after any break or after sleeping or whatever, I would always start by doing walking meditation and then I would sit. And it was actually really great. And when I came back from Burma, for a long time I continued that, because the walking practice not only gave a kind of nice energy, but also got me concentrated. And it was very nice then to go from the walking to the sitting. But I've stopped that now. So you can do the walking instead of the sitting. You can do it in conjunction with the sitting. If you want to experiment with sitting longer at home, you can sit for a certain period of time, walk for a certain period of time, and then sit for a certain period of time. And the period of time is up to you, what works for you. Some people will sit for 20 minutes, walk for 10, and sit for 20 minutes. Some people will sit for half an hour, walk 15, and sit for another half an hour. It's a way of sitting longer. And so your body and the factors of meditation, the mental factors, can all be balanced and keep you going in a nice way. And I encourage you to try it. It's really wonderful, walking meditation. And it's a great bridge into your daily life. try it, walking down the aisles of Safeway. Any questions about walking meditation? Yes.
How big did you say? Did you say like 20 paces?
I said 20 to 40 paces.
So it's
I used to say 20 to 30 feet, but I think it's somewhat variable. Yeah, you do it in your backyard or in your apartment. Sometimes, I mean, when I was in Burma, I just had this, many times I've had just a small room. And so sometimes you're limited by your room. And you have to find something that works. And if you have like a good place and it's really long, you find what works for you in terms of your pace and what kind of whatever works. But if it can be done in short distances. But usually 20, 30 feet is about the best. What happens often is that the mind is, you know, will wander away and get lost in thoughts. If you notice that it's happening as you do walking, and it's difficult to come back and be back in the walking, then you can do two things. You could, any time you feel agitated or feel kind of upset or feel too scattered in your walking, and stop kind of focusing on your feet as you walk and go back to establishing your ease. And always kind of go back and establish an ease, because that's, at least you can do that. You can stay present enough to do that. But if you find yourself scattered a lot and you doesn't want to stop, you can stop in your tracks and close your eyes and just stand there and take stock of thinking. Do thinking. Be aware of your thinking. Acknowledge it fully. And then let it go. And then when it's let go, you can start your walking again. Other questions? Yeah, Adam.
I find that I was wondering
I think some people might naturally kind of be aware of some different part of the sequence. The idea is to just choose one and stay with it, so you can really settle there and get to know that really well, rather than kind of wondering where you should be and go back and forth. But I think for most people, if you're aware of the foot that's stepping, you'll become aware of this foot as it's beginning to push off. And then you're aware of it as you go through the air, and then shifting your weight forward on it. Mm-hmm. And then as you're shifting your weight forward, the back foot begins to go up. And at some point, then the awareness will switch over there, but it's already beginning. And then you follow the rest of it, pushing up and lifting and going forward. So maybe that's enough for you. I don't know. Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm. Walking. Mm-hmm. I've done quite a bit of climbing and hiking also. Three times you take one step or you do the kind of thing. I found that when I was doing walking meditation, I sort of slipped into that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that's concentrating on two things at once.
Yes.
Because I was actually doing the lifting, forward, placing.
Some other schools of Buddhism, they teach a kind of walking meditation where you coordinate the breath with the walking, with the steps. But in our tradition, we usually discourage people from doing that because it's doing, as you said, two things at once. And so your attention is split. And what you want to do is to focus your attention on one thing, to really be present for it fully, so you can really let it speak to you in a deep way. So just stop doing your kind of, you can ignore your breath, you know, let your breath kind of do whatever it wants. Just keep your awareness on your feet. One more comment or question before we sit.
Several times, awareness of the difference of how it was carrying the weight and so on. If I walk on an incline,
more interesting because of the variations that you feel. But and it can help. Initially, it can help if your mind is really scattered. That interest and that variation can help you kind of get more centered. But at some point, the variation could get in the way, because if it's more or less repetitive, the same kind of, more or less the same kind of sensation each time you take a step, then you can really hone your awareness to the finesse, the particulars, the real details of each of those steps. If each of them is different from each other, you might be present, but you might not get the same level of concentration on each step. So the idea is to keep it as simple as possible, and just, you know, as level and simple and unobstructed, and don't too much use something special in the environment as an aid to help you be present. Just use your own mind to bring yourself carefully into your feet, your own awareness. But initially, it could be fine, you know, if your mind is scattered and not present. I've seen some people do walking meditation on stairs. They seem, somehow they thought that really worked well, because I guess it required, bigger sensations. Well, I don't know. So I know someone, one person did it because if you're sitting a long time this way and your knees hurt, get stiff, walking up and down steps is one of the best ways of, well, a very good way of loosening them up. So he always did it on steps. But that's my answer, my response. That makes sense? Mm-hmm. So why don't we sit now for another 15 minutes?